Good evening, and thank you for coming to what is the last of our series of medical halacha shiurim for the year, which means that I expect that next week, week after, I'll send out an email to those who have come to these and start calling for topics for next year. God willing, we'll continue our series. I want to thank Qualicare, as you saw on the sign outside, for sponsoring the series here, as well as the one at the Bayit this year. I'll also note, in case we have anyone with interest in dentistry, that our dental series concludes this coming Sunday morning, and that will be up at the Bayit, and the topic there is kashrut and dental devices, or something along those lines. So that'll be Sunday morning. Our topic for tonight is considerably more serious. Not to take kashrut lightly, but this is something that really is a life and death topic, and I think needs to be addressed that way. As I always say, please take practical questions to your shul rabbi. And actually, I had an embarrassing situation last night, which I'm going to say into the camera for those who are seeing this, and into the audio for those who are hearing the recording. I received a copy of a journal that comes out that has articles on halachic topics, and I saw the first topic was a topic that I find fascinating and that comes up over and over again in medical shiurim, was the topic of writing on Shabbos for medical purposes. And I said to my wife, that's great, because this is something that comes up and I'm really confused by it to a certain extent. I can't wait. So I opened it up, I start flipping through, and I found my name. Rabbi Mordechai Torchiner says that it may be claims that ... and he had a footnote to the Shir on YU Torah. But I'm very serious when I say that these are not meant to be practical go out and do this. These are discussions of halachic topics, and really I believe very strongly that practical halacha should be decided working with the rabbi of your shul. The topic of treating anxiety and depression is a tough topic because of two things. Number one, the seriousness of depression, and we're going to talk about different levels, but at its most severe, it is indeed, as we'll see, treated as pikuach nefesh, as a life-saving issue, life-threatening issue. And second is the extreme prevalence. And studies have been done, articles have been written. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But this is something, this is a disease which afflicts so many people, but unfortunately in such a private way, because people don't feel comfortable speaking about it, because it is stigmatized, because there's a sense that it isn't viewed the way other diseases are. When there's, when someone has a broken limb, or when someone has a tumor, so it's something that is very easy to identify and to diagnose, and it's separated from the question of who are they as a person. This is much more personal, and that makes it harder, but it makes it all the more important that we discuss it in an open way. So I gave you three vignettes on the sheet, three types of cases. If you take a look at the sheets, and for those who don't have them, I think you can probably get them from someone. Also, please make sure that you sign in. That's for multiple purposes. Certainly for anyone who wants CME credit, that's important. And then second, because it will allow me to follow up on questions that come up during the shiur. And then third, separate from that, it helps us to be able to follow up with a link to our evaluation form for the series, and it's important for us to get the evaluations filled out by as many people as possible. Even if you're not doing this for medical education credit, the university wants the evaluations, so that's important as well. I'll be sending out a link to the evaluation form online. Okay, so our three vignettes. Jason, 38, displays symptoms of depression and has spoken, albeit vaguely, of suicidal thoughts. It is Friday. The only option for commitment is a facility where kosher food is unavailable and which is not Shabbat friendly. May we commit, Jason? That's our first question. If I just left you with that question, what would you suppose? Yeah? Yes. Why? Pikuach nefesh. Even though his speech about suicidal thoughts has been vague. It's been, right. It's happened. Vague or not vague, he has expressed it. Okay. Other points of view? Yes. Food for Shabbos may be provided. So I made it not Shabbat friendly because no one's going to compel him necessarily to violate Shabbos. But if kosher food is unavailable, it's unavailable. Meaning hospitals, you know, to a varying degree, may have some latitude. But it's very hard to put that into a system where it's not already in place and certainly on the spot for a particular patient. May not be doable. I'm assuming for the sake of this vignette, it's not happening. He will end up eating non-kosher food. That's the first case. Let's take a look at the second case. Leah, a 25-year-old mother of two children, experienced heavy postpartum depression after both births, managing it with extensive therapy and drug treatment. She would like to begin birth control to avert future pregnancies. Might this be permitted? Now, birth control obviously includes a range of practices. So even if we say yes, the question then is, well, what kind of birth control? Barrier birth control is treated for differently than, let's say, her taking a pill. So understanding that, but also understanding that there is a basic reluctance within Jewish law to permit birth control in normal cases, what would you say in this case would be the answer given to her? Yes. Why? Right. She has children she needs to take care of, and the assumption is that her state, experiencing severe postpartum depression, would inhibit her ability to take care of them. That's certainly a factor. I also sort of avoided a problem when I wrote two children. I didn't want to get in the discussion of has she fulfilled the biblical mitzvah procreation with her husband, and so I'm just saying yes, they've already fulfilled it. I'm not dealing with whether they're boys and girls. Don't go there. It's not important for our discussion. But that's a second question that we need to address, the status of this postpartum depression. And then the third question. Joshua, a 45-year-old man, experiences racing thoughts and mania, for which he has begun a course of antipsychotics. So he's taking medicine. Is he permitted to take them on Shabbat, knowing that we have a rabbinic prohibition against taking medicine on Shabbos, which is, of course, overridden in life-saving situations, but there is a rabbinic prohibition against taking medicine in general. So is this fellow Joshua, who is experiencing racing thoughts and mania, we're not dealing with suicide now, but we're dealing with this sort of situation which could lead there. He has what could be called potentially an earlier stage. Is he allowed to take the medicine? Yes, we've got yeses all around. Any no's? Okay, so we have a group of people who have already decided the answers for all three, and well nigh universal in view. Let's see what we can see about this. First of all, in terms of defining the terms that we're using, when we talk about anxiety and we talk about depression, I am defining this in the following way. Anxiety, fear and panic in situations where most people would not feel it. It may be sudden. It may come on in particular circumstances. It may be chronic. That's anxiety. Depression, hopelessness, despair, anger, low energy levels, overwhelmed by day-to-day tasks and personal relationships. And again, that's going to vary moderate to severe. I don't pretend that that's a pure medical definition or that all doctors are going to agree. This is what I developed based on some doctors who I spoke with, and I hope that it represents a good core definition for us to work with. This is a phenomenon which we find over the centuries in Torah sources in many different cases. I brought one just because this is sort of a classic. If you take a look at source number one, Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, was the first Jewish king in Israel, and he is king until he falls out of God's favor, at which point God says, I'm taking the throne away from you, and instead I'm going to appoint your successor, this fellow by the name of David. And he appoints David while Saul is still alive and while Saul is still holding on to the throne. And Saul, as we find here in source number 1, Baruch Hashem Sara Meim Shaul, the Spirit of God left Saul, Ubiatsa Ruach Ra'a Me'ez Hashem, and a harmful spirit from God frightened him. And then we find Saul engaged in all sorts of behavior which really doesn't fit our impression of a righteous king of Israel. And take a look at what Abarbanel, Don Isaac Abarbanel, writing at the end of the 15th century, has to say about the state of mind that Saul is in. Sivavuhu bilahosu machshavos ra'os, in source number 2. He was surrounded by confusion and bad thoughts. V'haya tamid dimyono misasek be'onsho. His imagination was continually occupied with his punishment. Ve'ech kara Hashem es malchus Yisrael me'alav. How God had torn the throne of Israel from him. Ve'ech rucho atov sar me'alav. How his personal good spirit, his good feelings, had left him. Umitoch ze nisraf damo v'nishave bo choli hamelancholia. Abarbanel is quite familiar with the theory of humors that goes all the way back to Galen in the 3rd century and would persist until Paracelsus in the 17th century. And so he says, from this, because of this, his blood burned and he developed the melancholy disease, which happens from the burning of blood and red bile. Ugvar kasfu harofim, and the doctors have already written, that in this disease, imagination and the power of thought are destroyed. When a person is in this state, pain and worry befall him, he will fear and tremble and churn in depression. The term he uses for churning, v'yig'ash, is like the term we use in Hebrew for a volcano, har-gash. That's what he describes as going on within this person. Sorry? Okay, so this is Abarbanel's description of the state that Shaul falls into, and it fits very closely definitions we have for people who are undergoing anxiety and depression. A story in source number 3 is often taken in this way as well. Passage involving Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Nach nafshe de Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish passed away. Reish Lakish is a sage in the, call it, 4th century of the Common Era. And he passes away. Vava kamitzar Rabbi Yochanan basrei tuva. And Rabbi Yochanan, who was his sparring partner in yeshiva, is in great pain as a result. Now, there's a whole backstory about how Reish Lakish passed away, but it's not germane for our discussion. We're picking up with what happens after his death. Rabbi Yochanan is very upset. Amru Rabbanan, the sages said, man leza leis veledaite. They said, who's going to go settle the mind of Rabbi Yochanan? Someone has to help poor Rabbi Yochanan. Nezel Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas demachadet din shmeitze. Let Rabbi Lazar ben Pedas go. He's very sharp in his learning. He's going to take the place of Reish Lakish. And then we get a story. Azal Yosef Kamei, he goes to sit in front of Rabbi Yochanan. Kol milsa dava amar Rabbi Yochanan. Amar leitanya de Messiah lach. When Rabbi Yochanan would say anything within Torah, he would say, oh, I have a source that supports you. Amar, Rabbi Yochanan says to him, who are you kidding? At kibar lakisha? You think you're like the son of Lakish. You think you're like Reish Lakish. Bar lakisha ki haba amina milsa. Haba makshli chav dalet kushyasa. Umafarkina le chav dalet peruke. He says, when I used to learn with Reish Lakish, I would say something. He would challenge me 24 different ways, and I would give him 24 different answers. Omele rav chashmaisa. And that's the way our learning grew. From challenges. Ve'at amri tanya de mesayalach. You tell me, oh, I have a source to support you. Atula Yadana the Shapar Kamina. You think I don't know that what I said is good? I need you to tell me that you have a source to support me? Don't bring me sources that support me. Bring me sources that say I'm wrong. It's no laughing matter to Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan walks about tearing his clothing and crying. And remember that tearing one's clothing is a sign, Talmudically, of insanity. That is a particular character. We talked about this when we had Shiurim on capacity for consent for medical procedures, and we talked about the Talmudic symptoms for insanity. One of them is tearing one's clothing. So Rabbi Yochanan is described as walking about tearing his clothing and crying. Vamar hechad bar lakisha, hechad bar lakisha. He says, "Where are you, Reish Lakish? Where are you, Reish Lakish?" Vavakat savach. He is screaming. He's crying. He's wailing. Ad deshav daite mine, until his mind leaves. Bo Rabban and Rachmi Alev and Achnafshe, the sages prayed for mercy for him, and he died. The idea of praying for mercy for someone to die is a topic in its own right, and one worthy of a serious shir. But I bring this here because various authorities have quoted this and said what we're dealing with is indeed another variation on depression. He can't deal with it after he has lost his lost his close sparring partner from yeshiva, and the bond is so great that this loss is something he simply cannot overcome, and he suffers till his death. There are various clinical terms that are used in the Gemara, in the Talmud, to describe states of depression. Tiruf Hadat, Gandripos potentially, another term Rayon is used in the Talmud Yerushalmi, Yokra Deliba, a heavy heart. There are various sources that mention the black bile phenomenon associated with the four humors. If you take a look at source number 4, this is from Maimonides. He writes, in his aura alav mara shechora, one who has black bile rise up in him. Yasira, he should remove it. Bishmias shirim umine neginos, by listening to songs, types of music. Shirim might mean poetry. It might not mean musical song. It might refer to poetry. Ubetil biginos ubebinyanim naim, by strolling through gardens, by walking through beautiful buildings. Ubiyeshiva im suros nos, by sitting with pretty sculptures. Bekayotze bazemi mashayarchim hanefesh. Similar things that will broaden his spirit, the asir da'agas hamara hashchara mimena, and remove the worry induced by the black bile. Now, without going into the four humors, because that's a medical theory we don't really work with anymore, correct me if I'm wrong on that one, but I'm pretty sure. But the point is, what he is describing is, once again, the depression phenomenon. That's what he's talking about. And he's giving you a particular way to cope with it. But that's what he is observing. And again, it's important that we discuss this not just in terms of the classic sources, but okay, so what does Jewish law say about it? The importance of awareness of it is one step. The importance of, so what do we do about it in Jewish law is another. Although, I do want to take a minute before we get into the Jewish law piece of this to mention something else from my days when I was a shul rabbi. This is something that I spoke about from time to time, and I think it's important for us to be cognizant of. The relationships that we form with others in a community are important in their own right, but they're particularly important in terms of dealing with this. Meaning that there could be people all around you in your community who are struggling with this and who don't feel confident telling anybody about it. And how many times do you read an article in which, after, God forbid, something happens, people say, you know, I never knew, I didn't realize, and so on. And it's true. There can be people who are highly intelligent people and very capable of concealing what they're living with so that no one else is going to know. But it's not a good thing. It's a terribly destructive thing. And so it's important for us to make sure that we develop bonds with people such that we'll be able to confide in each other when something like this is going on, that they'll feel comfortable, and that people will be able to pick up symptoms. You can't out someone. You can't go to someone who's dealing with it and say, hey, I saw you, whatever. But on the other hand, opportunities can present themselves for someone to open up. And if you're there for them, you can save a life. So that's something that I wanted to stress. Yes?
I just wondered, how many people have depression? Is that what this is saying? Or is it going to be other things too? I'm getting...
So I don't see in these particular sources that we've looked at an indication that they are punishment. In the first case, the case of Saul, his punishment is loss of the throne. Depression is his reaction. The story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, his friend passes away, and he reacts that way. I don't see either of those expressed as punishment. The longer question, the question that's underneath that of, is illness ever a punishment, is not a topic for one class. That's a topic for a year-long series. There are various schools of thought within the Talmud about why people suffer. And to present a monolithic answer of people suffer because X would be to cheat the Talmud of the depth of the discussion. So I'm certainly not doing that in the next 5 seconds. Okay. So having introduced the fact that depression is, number one, present in Torah and present as described Talmudically and with various terms, and having talked a little bit about what we can do about it, how do we view it in Jewish law? So one might be tempted to say that, well, of course, it's people who are severely depressed, to start out with our first case, of course, that's a life-threatening condition, and therefore we have to act. And therefore, let's say if it's Shabbos, you break Shabbos for them. If it's an issue of kosher food, you don't worry about that. Commit them to wherever they need to be committed, and they'll eat whatever they're going to eat, and they're going to get treatment for their state, and they'll be safe. And that's a reasonable argument, which is where we're going to go. But just to mention two points that have to be noted first, if only to defeat them. Number one is the argument that it's very hard to diagnose the seriousness of the person involved. And while it's easy in the abstract to say, well, severe depression is a life-threatening condition, do whatever you need to do, when people are confronted with actual cases, they have a harder time. And that's not just in the framework of Jewish law. That's true in general. Meaning, a woman tells her husband, I'm feeling really down. And what she really means is more than just, I'm feeling really down. What she means is, she was driving the other day and she suddenly asked herself what would happen if she went into a wall. And her husband doesn't know. What do I say? What do I do? How do I respond? There are many people who face these situations and say, you know what, maybe we can make it through another day and we'll talk and things will get better or whatever it is. So it's not just a halachic question. It's a question beyond that in terms of just how people diagnose these, how people live with it. Even suicidal ideation may not be a danger sign. Even when people are formulating the idea in their head, there are plenty of studies on this that talk about, is it a danger sign, is it not a danger sign? So I invoke the rule that's in source number 5. The Hebrew is on the bottom of the first side, the English is on the top of the second side. We follow this in the laws of Shabbos, and we follow this everywhere else as well. Kol choli sha'arofim omrim shehu sakana. Any illness which doctors identify as dangerous, mechallin alav es ha-Shabbos, warrants breaking Shabbos. And if one doctor says you need to do whatever you need to do, and the other doctor says, nah, you can wait, don't worry about it, mechalin, you break Shabbos. When we are in doubt on a life-threatening issue, we go leniently, and by leniently he means that we will break whatever, Shabbos, kashrus, whatever it is, for the person. Doubt has to be resolved on the side of safety. That's what we're saying. Heshi. Correct. That's the case. Unless you see it specified otherwise, correct. Sometimes you'll see the term sakana, eiver, or something like that. Stam sakana, when you see the word sakana alone, it means danger to life. Shall we? Right. Right. So the question is, what about an earlier stage where right now it's not life-threatening? I'm going there, God willing, in another few minutes or 20.
So the question is, can they assess the transformation? Like, if you don't do this, it's possible that it could transform into that situation. If that's the case.
Right. So, yes, I expect to. If I don't, call me on it, but it's in my notes. So, Zev. Right, and this year a couple of weeks ago, the one up at the Bayit. Right. Correct. Different context, but yes. So that's number one. Number two, also an interesting point, although again, one that I bring up for the sake of defeating, but it's an interesting point from a philosophical perspective. You have a person who, let's say, I don't know, fell, and now they have a broken bone and it looks like it needs to be treated, or they have a person who spikes a really dangerous fever. So it's up to me to break Shabbos on their behalf. They're not a willing participant. They are the victim of some illness, and therefore it's clear to me that I should break Shabbos to save them. What about, I suggest in order to defeat, what about the argument of this person is saying, I'm going to take my life? Is it for me to break my Shabbos because he is saying he's going to take his life? Maybe the argument should be that's his action that he's choosing for himself. So the answer is no. The answer is that that's not the way we look at it. I give you source number 7. I'm skipping number 6 because we don't need it, but it also feeds into number 7. A particular story brought by the Chida, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, in his Birka Yosef commentary to Shulchan Aruch. Vayi hayom leil Shabbos Kodesh, one Friday night, Ira, it happened, Shenara Yisraelis shatsa sam hamavis, that a Jewish girl drank poison. And what he means by that is drank poison intentionally. She was trying to end her life. And signs of death began. And this source, Rabbi Azulai's source, is not talking about suicide. That's not really his key point. He's dealing with the question of amulets and writing an amulet on Shabbos as a medical treatment. And does that count as a medical treatment? Mind you, he's writing this several centuries ago. But Rabbi Azulai describes a certain man who was known as an amulet writer. The case came to him Friday night. Become because of a kameya lenara, and he wrote the amulet for her. Vetekev hikia v'amda al burya, and she vomited and she returned to health. Leave aside the question of how the amulet did this, what prescription was this, not the point for right now. We've had other classes where we've talked about alternative medicine. This is an alternative form of medicine. But the point is that that he did this, even though she had voluntarily done this herself, because we don't view it as voluntary. We view this as a function of an illness, and even if the person will say, let's take an extreme case, the person will say, I am doing this of my own volition, don't interfere, don't mess with it, and so on, nonetheless, we absolutely do break Shabbos to save the person's life. Question, though. What if you have a case of somebody who you think is indeed a threat to himself? And it's Shabbos. And I could say, or not even Shabbos, let's say it's not this Shabbos. Let's say it's an ongoing condition. But I could save them very simply. All I have to do is put them in a straitjacket. All I have to do is bind them up. They won't have any means of hurting themselves. And that will be the way that they will survive through Shabbos every week. So, should I do that in order to preserve their Shabbat observance? The answer is no. First of all, that won't necessarily work. People who want to find ways, but aside from that, from a halachic perspective, that's not the sort of measure that we require. And there are many, this comes up in many different ways halachically. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in his Aruch HaShulchan pointed out that technically one who steps on snow and ice and crushes it is violating a rabbinic law. Because you're not allowed to crush snow and ice, and granted he's doing it in an unusual way, but it's a guaranteed result of his actions, and maybe therefore you shouldn't be allowed to go outside when when there's snow and ice on the ground on Shabbos. And he says, nonsense, that's not what we require of people. We don't say you have to stay indoors all winter long. Rav Unterman, who was the chief rabbi in Israel decades ago, dealt with the issue of blindness. And he viewed blindness, saving someone from blindness, as saving that person's life, because he said the person's going to need to walk around outside, and he could fall and he could be attacked, and therefore if that person can get a treatment, but it requires breaking Shabbos for the sake of the treatment, you break Shabbos for the sake of the treatment. Now, mind you, other authorities disagreed with him, and I'm not giving a halachic ruling right now. My point is that he's asked the question in the course of his discussion, well, maybe the person could just stay home. And he says, that's nonsense. You don't compel a person to stay home. So certainly here, we're not going to say, well, you could, you know, preserve Shabbos by keeping the person from going anywhere and from doing anything. That's not an acceptable solution to the problem. And therefore, the overwhelming sense among halachic authorities is indeed that that dealing with depression will override name the halacha, name the law, it will indeed override it. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 9, number 8 is actually the quote about blindness. But if you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham writes, Cholep psychiatri kasha, a patient with a serious psychological condition, kagon hasovel midika on amok v'chule, such as someone suffering from deep depression, v'yesh chashash she'alu l'sakenes atzmo o'es acherim, such that we are concerned he might endanger himself or others, he is considered to be in the class of a dangerously ill person. We violate Shabbos for him as needed. Whatever needs to be done, that's what we do. Is there a question on the source? Okay. So we would do whatever would be needed. And the same discussion comes up in source number 10 regarding kashrut. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was actually a tshuva to a rabbi in Toronto in 1965, They dealt with the issue of committing someone to an asylum where he would not be able to get kosher food. And he wrote, Ulai yesh lidon mitzad machalaso im yomru arof im sheyesh bazeh inyan pikuach nefesh kegon da'alul mizeh la'arogis atzmo bim yiyelo ezet zahar. He says, perhaps there's room to debate, meaning to argue to permit committing him to this place because of his illness, such that the doctors would say that that it's a life-saving issue because he might respond to some tsar, to some pain, by killing himself. God forbid. Police. If you want to know how to write police in Hebrew letters, that's how you do it. Or he says, what if it's a person who won't commit suicide, but he's going to break the law, and if he gets into an altercation with the police, he's not going to listen to them, and he'll resist, and then they end up killing him, which sounds remote, but Ramosha is willing to entertain that as an immediate threat to life, who starts to tell you, Joey, about the case in which it's further removed and could lead there. Just to finish the source, and then he says, "Oh, yomru, osha yomru, de'etzem amachla he sakana." Or maybe the illness itself is dangerous. Shabala mikilkul shabemocho, because maybe it's coming from, in this particular case, some damage, physiological damage within the brain. Sometimes it's trauma induced. The EF Shalor Aposto, Alba Makamahu, and they can only treat him there in that facility. So that may be a reason to commit him. And Rav Moshe argues for committing somebody, even though he won't get kosher food, on these grounds. Right. I would quarrel with the word frequently because we hear about it when it happens. We don't know how many cases they resolve peacefully. So but you're right, it's in the headlines. These things happen indeed where somebody is deranged and either poses a danger, a real danger as a result of the derangement, or doesn't pose a real danger but is unable to cooperate with the police and therefore ends up getting hurt in the course of the altercation. But I think this effectively addresses question number 1. In our first vignette, where we ask the question of commitment to an asylum where it's not Shabbat friendly, won't get kosher food, the answer is very clear out of these responsa that yes, indeed, that's what we would do. It's not our best option. We'd prefer not. But remember the rule. I didn't include the sources on it here. I really ought to have included it. But remember the rule when it comes to saving a life. Because the logical follow-up question to what I just said is, what if you have a choice between two facilities? And one facility is a facility where they'll be sensitive to kashrut, and they'll be sensitive to Shabbat, and so on. But the facility that has the better medical reputation is the one that's not sensitive to these matters of Jewish law. So as a general rule, our principle that we follow when saving a life is you go where you have best medical odds. And if that means you're going to have to violate the law in order to go there as opposed to going to somebody else, that's what you do. So you would go to the institute where they have the best reputation for being able to handle this. Moving to vignette number two, take a look at source number 11. Responsum from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, dealing with a woman who, as I gave you in the vignette, had dealt with severe postpartum depression. He writes, "Be'isha shenishtates achar haleida b'shnei hayiladim shaholida." A woman who became insane, and he's using a legal term of insanity, the term shota, but I invite you to make the analogy to the medical terms as well, after the birth of her two children. V'arofim asru la lehishaber. And the doctors have said, you may not become pregnant. But she has a husband, and she wants to have normal relations with her husband. So, im yesh la hatira l'shamesh b'moch, the question that's put to Rabbi Feinstein is she allowed to use contraception? And you can see I left the date in. This is 1961 that he's answering this question. So his answer is, hine vadai tzadak kvot haras harav sheshtus hu inyan sakana. He says, certainly his honor, the person who wrote him the question, is correct, that insanity is a form of danger. Lo rak le'atzma, not just for herself, ela gam l'hayiladim aktanim, but also, as someone said before, for the children she's supposed to be taking care of. Sha'af mi sheshtuso eino la'asos ra. Even if you have someone whose state of depression or whatever form of irrationality is not the type to drive them to do something harmful, actually, that could change. That God forbid she could want to harm herself or the kids. He says there's no way that you could appoint guards who are going to be there in the house and prevent something from happening. That's nonsense. So he says, and therefore he permits her to use contraception. He even goes further in his responsum, permitting what would normally be considered the more severely prohibited forms of contraception, where those are needed because there are problems with using the lighter forms. And what I mean by that in general, without giving a shiur on contraception, is that he talks about the problems that come up with use of pills. And there are various problems that come up. First of all, for somebody with depression, he doesn't address this in his responsum, but there are issues of birth control potentially affecting the hormonal state and potentially throwing her off in terms of whatever treatment she's undergoing for the depression. That's number one. But number two, what he addresses is that the use of pills can cause staining, which can create problems in terms of a cycle of nida, of menstruation, and that will create other problems for her. And he's willing to permit, even beyond the pill, what are normally considered more strict prohibitions, use of barrier contraception. So that addresses number two. Yes? That's a really good question. Ellen asks, what about subligation? And I'm going to punt. To use an American football phrase, I don't know if that translates here. A lot of the question is going to depend necessarily on what the other options are. In other words, why not use the others? Is it because the surgery is going to give her as close as we can get to 100%, whereas these other methods are not guaranteed? Sorry? Yeah, it's an interesting question. I can put the question and to oppose sake and see what kind of an answer I get. So if you signed up, you'll get the follow-up email with that. It's a good question. Yes?
Well, I think the interesting corollary to that would be, would it make a difference if a future pregnancy endangered her because she
I think the general rule is yes.
So in other words, would you give a different answer if it was a different answer?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't believe so. I think the point is that we're equating them. Yeah. Yes, Karen?
In which case, presumably he was asked the question after two children, which makes the problem of fulfilling your family obligations easier. And also you've had two cases where it happened, but it just happened once. But if you had a heart condition after, you know, your first pregnancy, presumably your second pregnancy is dangerous, and you might say you're not allowed to have your second pregnancy. If you had a really bad depression after your first pregnancy, you say that's bad enough that your second pregnancy
Right. So Karen asks a really good question here. The, you know, like I said in the beginning, I fudged the question of have they fulfilled their procreation obligation by saying, well, they had two kids. But what if they didn't? What if it's clear cut? What if they had one kid? So the short answer is that according to most authorities, the obligation of having children is the male's obligation, not the female's obligation. And there are a whole host of reasons that are presented for that. But because of that, the man cannot fulfill his obligation to have children by putting her through a dangerous situation. So the answer would likely be the same. You would not say to her, well, you can't use contraception because your husband needs to fulfill this.
Yes. Might there also be a difference between a law that's the most severely frowned on contraception and a tubal ligation in terms of the action each time of using a law is a violation of that severe form of contraception as opposed to the one time use of the tubal ligation? Is that
It's an interesting question. I don't know. The question that was asked is that use of barrier contraception constitutes a violation of the law every time, whereas tubal ligation, the suggestion is, maybe is only a violation at the time of the surgery, but there's no violation every time that the husband and wife are together. So number one, I'm not 100% sure that that's so. But number two, yes, it would be an interesting factor to consider in you know, in weighing this. But this is a question I'm going to refer. This is not one that I'm going to handle myself. Okay. So moving from that to the next category, what about anxiety? What about a more mild form of depression? So within Jewish law, we tend to view anxiety and mild depression as particularly significant when you're dealing with somebody who is already ill, who already has some other problem. So for example, take a look please at source number 13. I'm skipping number 12 just because I don't feel it adds that much and we're already 40 minutes in. But you can, you know, take a look at it certainly and ask me about it afterwards. Source number 13, a passage from the Talmud dealing with a woman who is giving birth. So Omar Mar, they quote a statement here in source number 13, Im haisa tzricha l'ner, chaver tamalek eslaz haner. If a woman who's giving birth needs a lamp, so her friend lights a lamp for her. She needs light. So the Gemara says, the Talmud says, Pshita, well isn't that obvious? She's giving birth. This is a life and death situation. We do whatever we have to do for her. Why wouldn't you light a lamp? So he says, Lo, tzricha besuma, because we're talking about, he says, a blind woman. And therefore the light isn't changing anything for her. Mau disema came into lochazia asur. I might have said she doesn't see, and therefore this is prohibited. Kamash malan ayisuve miyas vadaita. But it teaches us that we still need to settle her mind, because savra yika midi chazia chaverta ba'avdali. She thinks to herself, if I need anything, my friend will see it now because there's light in the room. So therefore, I am entitled, and this, remember, lighting a light is violating a biblical prohibition. But you can do it to settle her mind. Ah, but an unsettled mind is hardly suicidal. An unsettled mind is not life and death in and of itself, but she's already in a fragile position. And therefore, we consider this form of anxiety to be significant enough to warrant that that violation. Similarly, the Talmud at the end of the volume of Bava Batra talks about a person who is dying and upholding a dying person's wishes in order to settle his mind, because that will affect his health in these last moments. So the halachic authorities tend to consider this very significant. If you take a look at source number 14, the Mishnah Berurah, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, writing 100 years ago, 110 years ago, says, on the case of the woman who's giving birth, even if her friends know how to do all the things she needs, nonetheless, the sages understood that she's not going to have a settled mind as long as she's in the dark, and telling her, don't worry, we know what we're doing, is not adequate. And therefore, we would turn on the light on her behalf. So, in another case, dealing with the discussion of a man who's going into the hospital for some disease, which is such that they need to burn his belongings once he leaves the hospital. What this disease is, I discussed in an earlier class a couple of years ago, and doctors made various suggestions for what this could have been. But Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, a rabbi in England, was asked the question of, do you have him bring tefillin into the hospital? Knowing that, they're going to burn them when he leaves, and that's a very serious violation of Torah law, burning his tefillin. On the other hand, this is a religious, observant person who is going to be very upset if he can't put on tefillin, because he knows that the law of putting on tefillin is a serious one. He knows that the Talmud has condemnation of people who don't put on tefillin and so on. And so he's very agitated and upset. And he says, you do it. You give him the tefillin, knowing full well what's going to happen to them at the end of the hospital stay. Rabbi Yitzchak Waldenberg and his Tzitz Eliezer has a long discussion of this as well. But on this basis, a patient who has some other form of illness and is also manifesting anxiety, even if it doesn't rise to the level of severe anxiety, severe depression, would be treated for this in violation of even in some of the cases that we see are biblical law. That's important. Second, though, what if he's not suffering from anything else? What if it's just the depression? It's a mild depression. It's anxiety. Would we let him take medicine for it on Shabbos? I gave the case in the third vignette, the patient with racing thoughts. So knowing that there's a rabbinic prohibition against taking medicine on Shabbos for reasons that are beyond the scope of the shiur tonight, I mentioned it in the shiur 2 weeks ago and had enough fun with the discussion then. But there is indeed such a prohibition. What will I say for this? For this patient. So Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in his Mishnah Brura notes that if an illness consigns a person to bed, we would violate rabbinic prohibitions on his behalf. Tying into, and including allowing him to take medicine. Tying that in here, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in his Tzitz Eliezer deals with the case of sleeping pills. For someone who is anxious and unable to sleep, can he take sleeping pills on Shabbos? And he concludes that there is room to permit. And on that, you get the footnote that I bring you in source number 15. Benogea lekichas kadure slikt. I don't know what slikt is, but it was some brand of sleeping pill. Lashena b'Shabbos. As far as taking these sleeping pills to sleep on Shabbos. Heishiv lo akach harav agon David Zvi Hoffman. He quotes the great rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, a rabbi in Germany. And the Kosei Vizelashano, this is what he wrote. Benogea letrufos lashena, eineni ro'eh hevdel bein samei shena ubein trufos acheros. He says, I don't see any difference between sleeping pills and other medicines. He says you take other medicines to treat other parts of the body. You take sleeping pills to treat nerves. Now, how they actually operate medically and whether they're operating on the nervous system or some other part is not the point. The point he's making is that the person who is suffering from anxiety and is therefore unable to sleep should be viewed as someone who has an illness. And when a person has an illness that confines them to bed, that is that bad, they're not going to go traveling around outside, then at that point, we would say, you override the rabbinic prohibition against giving medicine, and that patient would take the medicine. And so, looking at vignette number 3, the answer is yes, that patient should continue taking the medicine on Shabbos. So we're all in agreement, the answers are yes. I just took 45 minutes to get there. But we still have one more question, which I didn't put into a vignette, but is certainly important and was asked before. What about the patient who is not currently manifesting dangerous symptoms? But, untreated, that's where this is going. So, what do we say right now in terms of the state of the patient? So, we discussed this in a different shiur when we talked about treatment of lacerations on Shabbos and the question of infection and treating somebody's wound now in order to prevent a dangerous infection from developing. And we said that indeed one does. One is supposed to treat that wound, including in ways that we would consider to be violation of Shabbos, in order to prevent an infection. One example discussed by Yeshua Neu in a Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa is if the edges of the wound seem to be infected and you can just cut away that area in order to keep the infection from spreading. So he says that's what one would do. We take the same approach to danger from depression. Take a look at source number 16, please. Rabbi Yitzhak Zilberstein writing in the journal Asia. Amar Agon Rabbi Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik. He quoted Rabbi Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik, the Briska Rav, Harabi Brisk, Lerofe, Pikuach Nefesh, Ein Perusho Sheka Es Yistaken V'yamus. Saving a life does not mean that the person in front of you is right now in a position to die. He's dealing with Yom Kippur. His discussion there is eating on Yom Kippur. Ela af im hatzom yashpia alav ka'avor shanim ka'asher yitakev shuv b'machala. He says, even if fasting on Yom Kippur, I can't imagine this medically, but even if fasting on Yom Kippur could endanger him years down the road, when his illness, whatever it is, comes out of remission, ve'ekev tzom ze yamus lefnei zmano, so that fasting on Yom Kippur this year could cause him to die early, in such a case, gam ze bechla pikuach nefeshu v'chayev ka'es le'echol. That's also saving a life, and therefore he's required to eat now. That's a remarkable statement. But Rabbi Yitzhak Zev Soloveitchik has the shoulders to make that statement. Yes? Really? Hypoglycemia affecting the brain down the line. Okay, so there's an example. This is discussed also in source number 17. I bring this source also because it's a local source. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Graubart was a rav in Toronto. He wrote this in 1934. He said he's dealing with the case on Yom Kippur of someone who had been psychotic in the past. And now the question is, should he fast on Yom Kippur, or should we be concerned that it could trigger another episode? And so Rabbi Graubart wrote, I believe Rabbi Graubart was instrumental in the creation of the first Eruv in Toronto. I think that was his doing. He says, Aval nira de'ein misham raya lahatir kadeshalo titrov daito, disha'ani asam shuchole, chayshinan shim titrov daito yisgaber cholyovi avoli de sakana. He's dealing with the question here immediately of a healthy person who has had no sign of this problem in the past. And he says, don't compare it to the case of the person who was ill. He says, in the case of the person who had this before, that's a different story because we are worried that he could become upset, that his illness could increase and endanger him. But if someone is otherwise healthy and we have no reason to suspect a problem, that you can't do. In other words, the person says, let me eat on Yom Kippur, because if not, I could lose my mind. So we tend not to take that literally. We tend to assume that this is not that extreme. Even if you have a reason to think it is, if there's a history, then you're no longer dealing with a healthy person. We're talking about here where you're dealing with somebody who is healthy. He says the patient who has a history should indeed not be fasting on Yom Kippur. The only requirement is that we have some evidence to go on that this could lead there. So you get a cautionary responsum in source number 18. I brought you papers to look at in source number 19 because it's a fascinating problem. One of the questions that always comes up within these issues of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, is what if I'm wrong? What if I broke Shabbos? What if I broke kosher? What if I fill in the blank in order to save somebody it wasn't really needed? And the answer we always give is, you break it and don't think about it again, because that's what you're required to do. You are in doubt. This is what you are expected to do. Don't start questioning yourself for what you needed to do. What you did was right. That's the principle. But it comes up not just within Judaism, it comes up in the general context when there's a heavy price to pay on the other side. So it comes up in the topic of therapeutic abortion. When you're dealing with the case where they say they want to abort a fetus who is possibly or probably malformed for the sake of the mother's health and what's going to happen if she carries the baby to term and so on, there are studies that have been done on this, and that's what I refer you to in source number 19. But taking a look at number 18, Rav Wozner, in his Shevet Halevi, deals with this and says, he is uncomfortable. Were we to permit abortion for this purpose, God forbid, we would be extending a hand to sinners to be lenient in killing a fetus. He said there's no cause to think this is possibly life-saving right now. Calming her spirit and depression would be a mitzvah. He's not willing to go that far in the therapeutic abortion line, and this is a long debate, not just in our sources, but in secular sources, on how you deal with this and how you deal with the culture that you create once there is such a concept of abortion for the sake of the mother's mental health. We do absolutely believe in abortion in cases where it threatens the life of the mother. You have to discuss which trimester and what the problem is and what the level of risk is, as in any assessment. But his concern is where it's on mental health grounds that you're opening up a Pandora's box because of the culture that it creates, and he's not willing to go there. It's clearly an issue that there will be some debate on, but that's his position. Yes?
Well, what if the mother is suicidal? Like the pregnant woman is suicidal.
Right. Right, so that's not the case that he's dealing with. Now let me turn the question back to you instead of answering it. Where the mother is in this position of suicidal, what do you do with the fact that she has a baby inside her? In other words, if I had a situation in which I had two people standing there, and one of them said, I'm going to kill him or I'm going to kill myself, what would I now do? You know, with this person. Now, the fetus is not the equivalent of a person standing there within Jewish laws. That makes this more complicated. But it's not a simple and straightforward assessment. That's all I would say at this point. As I said at the outset, I've learned the lesson about things that I say on record and being quoted and used and all that. So I want to avoid endangering myself. But I want to do a quick summary, and then there's a key announcement that is going to be made. But in sum, number one, we started out by talking about the seriousness of this and its prevalence, and I stress the point that I want to stress again now, that it's important to build relationships with people in the community such that you'll be there for someone who is dealing with depression. It's important to look out for those signs and to look out for others. We talked about some of the cases in which depression or something awful lot like it appears in Tanakh, appears in Talmud. We talked about the question of viewing pikuach nefesh as viewing depression as pikuach nefesh, as a life-threatening condition, despite the fact that it's something he would do to himself, despite the fact that it can be hard to diagnose. Nonetheless, we said we do view it as life-threatening. We do not say, well, just straitjacket the person, keep the person from acting. That's not an acceptable solution. And instead, we will indeed override various Jewish laws in order to save that person. In terms of the halachic weight of anxiety and mild depression, we said if the person has some other illness, they're already weakened, then indeed we will override biblical law for them. If there isn't if there isn't a separate condition endangering them, we would override rabbinic law, such as having them take the medicine on Shabbos. The patient who is not manifesting yet, but might develop it, if we have any reason to think this is going there, then we adopt that view that was stated regarding Yom Kippur, and we say it's considered to be dangerous right now. We do not wait for it to become dangerous. I'm going to stick around for questions after one announcement, which I think Jeff is making. So I'm going to turn the floor over to Jeff, and then I'm going to stay here to discuss as long as people want. Belinda.